Okay, everybody, so let's start off with some meditation first of all. So just as usual, just close your eyes, sit nice and comfortably. And once you close your eyes, just feel your body for a couple of minutes. And as always, make sure you're nice and comfortable where you're sitting. No tensions anywhere, just nice and easy, nice and relaxed. Any tension you have in the body comes from the mind. So if the body is tense, there's also some tension in the mind. So by relaxing the body, you're doing a twofold thing. You're feeling at ease physically, and you're also improving the ease of the mind at the same time. So go through the body, feel the typical areas where people often have tension, like the stomach region. And if you feel any tension there, just breathe in, take a few deep breaths, and just allow the tension to dissipate as you breathe out. Next, move your attention from your stomach to your shoulders. Again, feel if you have any tensions anywhere in your shoulders. And imagine yourself breathing in through the shoulders. And as you breathe out, allow the tension to dissipate. Attention to your face, and the same thing again with your face. Is there any tension there? If you find you feel a bit tense anywhere, breathe in through that tense area and then allow the thing, all the tension, to dissipate as you breathe out. And then keep on going through the body like that, all the different areas of the body, particularly those areas where normally tension accumulates, and make sure that you're nice and relaxed throughout the meditation experience. If you start to get tight in the body, it's usually a sign that the mind also is not relaxed. So go through the body, make sure it's nice and at ease, you're feeling nice and comfortable, then you know you're going in the right direction. So keep on doing that. Every time you feel something wrong, go back and relax it again and again and again, until you feel really good inside yourself. Just try to feel how nice it is to sit there all by yourself, peaceful, quiet, the body being at ease. Get a feeling for how beautiful that is, the sense of peace, the sense of quietness, the sense of neither comfort nor discomfort, the body is neutral, and just feel the peace of that situation. And as you sit there, you will notice that all kinds of things happen inside of you. Sometimes you think something, a thought comes through your mind. Sometimes you feel a bit tired, perhaps. Other times you have some sort of fantasy happening. Maybe there's a pain coming up. All sorts of things happen inside of you. And the way to achieve peace with all these kind of things is never to interfere, never to try to control these things, never say it's wrong to think, never say it's wrong to be tired. If you're tired, that's fine. Accept the tiredness. If you think, it's fine. Accept the thought. If you have a pain that lasts a little bit longer than usual, then move the body so you get comfortable again. Make sure you enjoy the meditation experience. And in this way, by accepting, slowly, the mind calms down all by itself. Give it time, be patient, and things become nice and peaceful. Now turn your attention to all the people here today, all the people together with you on this retreat. And just remind yourself for a few seconds, a couple of minutes, how wonderful and how fortunate you are to be with such good people doing a meditation retreat like this. All the people in here are people who are kind, good-hearted, virtuous, compassionate people who are trying to do something good in the world. And how difficult and how rare it is to find a group of people like this. And how wonderful it is, how fortunate you are, each one of us, to have such good companions on the spiritual path. Let's reflect on that for a couple of minutes. And now, wish all these people in this room, everyone out there, each one of you, may you be happy, may you be well, may you be free of suffering, may you find peace and contentment in your life. Something simple that you can wish from your heart to each one in this room. And now spread that goodwill and kindness, spread it outside of this retreat center. Take it across the road over to the monastery. And wish all the monks and the anagarikas and the lay people staying over there, each one of them also very good people, people trying their best to live a good and virtuous life. May each one of them also be find happiness, contentment, freedom from difficulties and suffering in life. And now take that well-wishing and take it out even further to all the farmers around in this area, to all the people who live down on the flats, down in Serpentine, all the people out there. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to be free of suffering. And everybody has much more suffering in life than they ever want. So bring up a sense of compassion and wish them freedom from problems. Wish them happiness and peace. All these people in the local area, faceless people, people you have never met before. And spread your well-wishing and compassion and kindness even further out, out and out, covering suburb after suburb, like a warm blanket, enveloping people on a cold day. Your sense of kindness and compassion coming around and making them feel better. All the people out there, including the nuns' monastery in Gijaganap, all the animals that are so vulnerable to exploitation, everyone, all these beings, may they all find freedom from suffering. May they find contentment and happiness in their lives. And now take all the kindness and well-wishing that you have generated and bring it back towards yourself. And also wish yourself well. May I too be happy. I too have much more suffering and pain in life than I wish I would have. May I find freedom from this suffering. May I find peace and contentment. Okay, so that's the end of the meditation. So please come out and sit nice and comfortably here. Okay, so not sure if I should teach or Teddy should teach. I think Teddy teaches best by remaining silent, actually. Yeah. So that's really good. So I'm just going to give a little bit of a talk, I thought, first of all, and then after the talk, I will go through the questions. There's quite a few questions here. So I'm not going to talk long. I'm just going to basically get on some basic themes of meditation practice of Buddhism, and just to give you some kind of feel for this thing, meditation practice. Are many people here on the retreat for the very first time? Or many? Yeah? Okay, quite a few. Okay, great. Okay, good. So we keep it simple. It's always good to do the simple stuff, because really meditation is a very, very simple thing. You know, you read the suttas, you read what the Buddha said, and you sit down, and you breathe in, and you breathe out, and you watch the breath, and that's really all meditation is all about. And yet, people find it very hard, but it is, we make it hard, it actually is very simple. So, because of that, it's actually very useful to always go over the basics, the foundation stuff, again and again, until you understand how to actually do the foundation things in meditation. One of the things that I always like to think about with meditation, and this goes back to when I first became a Buddhist, and I first became interested in Buddhism, and I started reading about the Buddha's teachings, and I thought, it's all about happiness and suffering, this Buddha's teaching. It's about how to find contentment in life, how to find compassion, how to find peace, how to get away from suffering. And everything in Buddhism was about this, you know, how to actually achieve all these very valuable, worthwhile states, things I could relate to straight away. And I thought in my own life, and I realized that not only me, but all the people around me, this is what we all want. We all want happiness. We all want to get away from suffering. We all want to have more peace, more contentment, more sense of love in our lives, all these kind of things. This is what everybody wants. Everybody wants this. And I realized very quickly on that the Buddha's teaching really is the answer to the meaning of life. And that was such a powerful insight for me when I realized that. I thought, gee, here is the answer to the meaning of life. I thought there was no such thing as an answer to the meaning of life. I thought that was one of those imponderable questions. Either that or the answer was 42 or something, according to the... But it's basically here I realized there actually is such a thing as the answer to the meaning of life. And that is found in the Buddhist teachings. And that really made me very committed after a while as a Buddhist when I realized that. And it is the same thing. Meditation is a very integral part of Buddhism. So because meditation is an integral part of Buddhism, it means that when we meditate, we should also look for the same things. We should look for the sense of ease, the sense of peace, the sense of happiness, the sense of freedom from suffering. And when we get these things out of our meditation practice, maybe get is the wrong word, when these things happen in our meditation practice, that is when we know that we're on the right path. When we feel good about ourselves, when things are going right, we feel relaxed, that is when meditation is right. If you feel tight, if you feel like tense, if you feel uncomfortable, if you have lots of pain and all these kind of things and you want to go home, then it's not working right. So be careful of those things. Make sure that you find the ease and the happiness in meditation. That is what it's all about, because that is what the Buddhist path is all about, what Buddhism is all about. And that gives you a kind of a marker, in a sense, in your practice to know whether you're doing the right thing or not, whether you're on the right path or not. How are you feeling? Always see whether it's heading in the right direction. And I know for myself, I've been a monk now for 16 years or something. And I know that the reason why I'm still here doing this, living this monastic life, is because it is giving the results that the Buddha promised. It's a gradual thing. You know, sometimes it goes very slowly, but gradually going the right direction. And you should see the same thing in your meditation practice. So watch yourself when you're sitting on the cushion. What's happening here? Are you finding that ease, or are you becoming tense? And if you're becoming tense, don't try to sort of sit it out or allow yourself to feel uncomfortable or whatever. Try to find out the reason, the cause why you're becoming tense. If you're becoming tense, it usually means too much willpower. You're trying to control the situation, you're trying to control your mind, control your body. And control always gives rise to tension and a lack of ease. So be at ease, be just relaxed, enjoy yourself, don't force things too much. If you have to, get up and do some walking meditation instead. Go for a walk in the forest. Go back to your room, lie down on your bed or whatever. Do whatever it takes to get back to that sense of ease. And then come back again into the hall. And you will have noticed when I talk about meditation practice, always begin by focusing on the body. Because that is where you can very often see the tension arising in the body. By following the body all the time, being aware of the body, you can know whether you're going in the right direction or not. So that is the first kind of signpost in the meditation practice that sort of guides you in the right direction. Another one, which also is very important, is to remember that the Buddha's teaching is a path of purity. It's about purifying yourself. And the whole teaching is about a path of purification from the very beginning to the very end. The Buddhism starts off with morality. You have to be kind and good to other people. You purify yourself in that way. Then purification continues through meditation practice. And then purification goes all the way until you attain Nibbana, according to the Buddha's teachings. So look at yourself, what's happening. Are you becoming more pure? Do you find that your mind, that you're becoming less angry, that you're becoming less tired, you have greater clarity than you had before? All of these things are signs of purity of the mind. When you have greater clarity, confusion is a sign of impurity. Clarity is a sign of purity. So watch yourself, what's happening on a short retreat like this. Are you feeling more pure? Are you feeling that you see more clearly than before? That you all of these things are sort of coming together. And that purity is the other sign. So these two signs are very kind of good ways of judging whether things are going right or not. So use these as a kind of milestone. Maybe signpost is rather the better word to use. So use this as signposts in a meditation practice and any Buddhist practice that you do. So once you know, this is basically the why we meditate. We meditate for purity. And this is also the what meditation is all about. Meditation is about this happiness and ease, essentially. So once we know that, then we can start thinking about meditation itself. How to go about the actual meditation practice. Now, one of the interesting things that I read, when I read the word of the Buddha and what the Buddha says, I find it very fascinating. There is a sutta or a discourse by the Buddha where he talks about mindfulness of breathing, which is like one of the basic meditation practices in the suttas. But what the Buddha says about mindfulness of breathing is that before you even sit down, before you even can watch the breath, you have to establish mindfulness, first of all. If you cannot establish mindfulness, mindfulness of breathing doesn't even begin. So you have to have mindfulness before anything else works. And that is a very important thing to keep in mind, because if you find that you're not really mindful, if you find that you are drifting off all over the place, if you're falling asleep, if you're very restless or whatever, then it is impossible to watch the breath, because mindfulness has to be established first. It's a very, very important teaching, because very often people go onto the breath far, far too early. And you will find that there are teachers that give you all kinds of ideas about how to hold on to the breath, so to speak. They tell you to count the breath or to recite the alphabet or something like that with the breath. And it works to some extent, but it also tends sometimes to make you a bit tense, because you are using a technique that forces the mind onto the breath. The ideal way of doing mindfulness of breathing is to sit down, to relax, to allow everything to become quiet and peaceful, just like we tried to do before. And then you notice there comes a point when the mind is peaceful, but you feel relaxed, you feel at ease, the mind is clear. There's maybe a little bit of thinking, but not much thinking happening, not much thinking going on. And that is when you know that mindfulness is good. The clarity is there. There's not much thinking happening. And that is a sign that mindfulness has arrived. And what happens at that point is that because you are just aware, you're just clear, you're just present in the room, and maybe you hear some noises and you can maybe feel your body, and there comes a point, because mindfulness is strong, that suddenly the breath arises in your mind, in your perception. Suddenly you start feeling the breath. And that is when the right time is to watch the breath. When the breath comes all by itself, sort of sneaking in on you, when you least expect it, that is the right time to do breath meditation. So that is a very high, that is why breath meditation is so difficult, because most people find it hard even to be mindful, not let alone actually focusing on the breath beyond being mindful. That is why it is so difficult. That is why so much time needs to be, so much work needs to be placed on actually attaining that mindfulness to begin with. Because then the meditation happens, in a sense, all by itself. So try to get at least to that point where you have the mind is clear, where there isn't too much thinking going on, when you feel nice and at ease. And then once, if you get to there, you have done a lot of the hard work that is called meditation practice. But sometimes we also need a few things to do, because sometimes we feel, oh, I'm not getting anywhere, nothing is really happening, I can't get that peaceful. So what do you do in that situation when that happens? And what you do is what you need, if you find that after a couple of days your mind does not become peaceful, or it is still very tired or whatever, the reason often for that is because perhaps you haven't been practicing the Buddhist path for long enough yet. You haven't purified yourself, if you like, enough. And for that reason, the mind has a hard time gaining that clarity. Lack of purity leads often to lack of clarity in the mind. So to improve the clarity and to improve the purity, one very powerful thing to do is to practice some metta meditation. Metta, loving-kindness meditation. And loving-kindness meditation is a little bit more active than just watching the breath or just being in the moment. And also it has the great advantage that it actually prepares you for watching the breath. So once, if you're able to get some of the good feelings come up inside of you, wishing other people well, wishing yourself well, once those feelings actually arise in your mind, then you can go back to the present moment again, and you will find that the present moment is much easier to be with once you have that good feeling inside of you. Why is that? Because when you feel good inside of you, you want to be here right now. You don't want to be somewhere else. You don't want to think about something. You don't want to dream. You don't want to fantasize. You don't want to be angry, anything like that. You feel good, so you want to be right here, right now. And then you can gradually, carefully move back again towards the breath and towards the present moment. And you find that it actually starts to work. So the metta, loving kindness, combined with a present moment awareness and breath meditation is a very powerful and very important technique. And when you read the discourses of the Buddha, you find that he indeed precisely emphasized these things a lot. Metta, he talks about again and again in sutta after sutta, discourse after discourse. And breath meditation is probably the most important meditation technique that the Buddha ever taught. So these two things are very, very important and very useful on the Buddhist path. Just some maybe very general hints on how to do metta, loving-kindness meditation. Now the important thing here in metta meditation is to be able to find an object in the mind that you can feel goodwill towards. If you have something you find it very difficult to have goodwill towards, it's going to be very difficult for you to give rise to a sense of wishing them well. Because this has to come from the heart, right? You really have to wish the other person well. May you be happy. May you be free of suffering. When it comes from the heart, that is when it becomes powerful. If it doesn't come from the heart, if it's sort of just something you go through the process of saying, may you be happy, it's not really going to work. You really have to mean it. You really have to have those good intentions. So because of that, the object that you choose is very important. You have to find a person or a group of people that you genuinely feel good towards. And you are very, this is one of the reasons why I suggested start with the people around you here today, because it's great that you have a group of people who practice well, who are good, kind, caring people. Those are the kind of people it's easy to have a sense of metta towards. Or if you have a teacher, maybe you consider people like Ajahn Brahm your teacher, somebody who you consider has lots of good qualities. Again, they are wise and they are compassionate and they are kind-hearted. Again, that is the kind of person, somebody you respect very highly, somebody you can very easily have metta, loving-kindness towards. So start off with that sort of person. And once you get it going, once you get that good feeling going, by wishing a respected person well, then you can move it around and take into account other beings as well in the same way. Another way of doing it is to do it towards somebody, or not somebody, towards like a group of people that you never met before. You can, for example, just think of the Eastern Direction and all the people in the Eastern Direction. People you don't know, people you never met before. But you know that all people are the same. They all want that happiness. They all want to be free of suffering. And how difficult it is, impossible almost, to get rid of that suffering in life. Nobody is ever happier than they want to be. And if you know that, if you can sort of sympathize and empathize with the suffering of people out there, their desire to be happy, then wish them well. May you be happy. May you be free of that suffering. Then, again, it's another way of giving rise to that good feeling inside of you, wishing people well. And once the feeling comes up, once you start to really feel, may these people be well, then come back to the present moment and see if you can start, maybe try to watch the breath. All these things go together here. Okay, so those are just some very simple and general hints, a very, very short talk for you. But there are all these questions here as well, so I'm going now to get into these questions. Is there any other questions before I start on the written ones? Everybody happy? Everybody content? Yes, sir. Can do, yes, because a child is often very vulnerable and very kind of prone to all kind of suffering. You're trying desperately to communicate with you, I want this, and you don't know what he wants. You know, it's the kind of, yeah, so a child is often very good. Yeah. Okay, so let's try some of these questions here. What do you teach about loving your partner or about soulmates? Okay. Well, basically, when we talk about metta meditation in Buddhism, you have to be very careful not to confuse it with like romantic love, because these two things are very different kind of things. Metta is a very selfless type of love. It's something that you have for somebody you've never met before, a faceless person, somebody who may even be your enemy. This is what metta is about. If you try to have metta towards somebody that you are romantically linked with, it tends to go in the wrong direction, and it goes off into the wrong kind of tangent. It's supposed to be a pure kind of love, a love that is not tainted by any kind of desire. It's a completely selfless kind of love, where you don't really have any self-interest at all. It's loving a person just because they are a being out there suffering and having a hard time in the world. That is what it's really about. Now, that is why it is often said you should not actually focus on your partner or your soulmate or whatever when you do metta meditation. You should actually focus on people that you ideally don't know, or somebody who is maybe a spiritual teacher, or somebody you know but just an acquaintance that you don't have any kind of emotional bond to. Very often it's good to focus on somebody of your own gender. As soon as you cross genders, it creates problems. So focus on somebody on your own gender, because that makes it much more neutral and a much more pure kind of metta and love. Of course, it will also affect your relationships that you have with somebody you are romantically linked with. If you have a general sense of metta, it will also improve your relationship with whoever you're with. But don't use them to generate the metta meditation when you meditate. Rather, allow them to be the beneficiary of your meditation afterwards, when you come out and you find that your general conduct in daily life improves dramatically because you have more kindness inside of you. So everybody becomes beneficiaries anyway of your metta meditation. You don't have to include romantically linked people in your meditation as such. Could you please explain impermanence? Okay. now we get into the foundations of Buddhism here, impermanence. Let me just check if there are some more things on meditation before I go into that one, because we're really getting into some deep Dhamma here rather than meditation questions. Let's have a quick look. Okay, I think I might as well start with this more. Looks like people have a lot of interest in kind of more general questions, so we'll move on to the more general questions. So, okay, so what about impermanence? What does it actually mean in Buddhism? And impermanence in Buddhism is basically just the idea that when you start observing the world, in particular when you start observing yourself and knowing yourself, your own body, your own mind, you find that there is nothing in here that you can hold on to as this is like the final me. This is my soul, this is myself, this is who I am. There's nothing permanent in this world. And this is what impermanence is about. Impermanence is about this understanding that things are always changing. And this is what you find out very quickly when you start to meditate. You sit down and you look inside of yourself and you watch your mind, you watch your thoughts, you watch whatever is happening. And you see it's changing all the time. Things are always moving around. And the more you try to look for something in there which is like the permanent you, the real thing, you find there is no such thing. Things are always, always changing. And this teaching of impermanence is very, very profound because it goes to the point, and this is we're coming to the very core now of the Buddhist teachings. It goes to the point when you realize, have a kind of final breakthrough, that there's nothing inside of you whatsoever that has this quality of always being there, stability, which always is part of you, always, which is the true you behind all the changing curtains of all this kind of this theater, this show which goes on all the time. There's no kind of permanent screen behind that. Things are always changing. And this is what we're trying to, in a sense, achieve in Buddhism finally, is to see that sense of impermanence. When you see that, this is also where non-self comes in, because if there is nothing permanent inside of you, it also means that there is no self, because the self is this idea of a permanent aspect inside of you. So when you see impermanence, you also see non-self. And it's a very powerful thing that you can actually use also in your meditation practice. You can reflect on impermanence. Because what the reflection on impermanence does, it allows you to detach a little bit from the things that you are contemplating as impermanent. And it doesn't make you, it allows you not to hold on quite so tightly. And if you take, for example, the romantic relationship, it's very often people get very, very attached to the people that they are romantically linked to. And it's natural. That's why we have those relationships in the first place. But you are set, very often, you're also setting yourself up for pain, because no relationship is going to last forever. At the very latest, it's going to end when you die. And death, it comes often very fast. We're going to live maybe for 70, 80 years. It isn't that long. Then it's all over, and then you have to say goodbye. And the stronger your attachment is, the more painful that separation is going to be. So by remembering impermanence, we are letting go a little bit, not holding on quite so hard, because we realize, actually, I can't hold on to this. It's impossible. I'm trying to, there's a famous simile of Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand. And he said, looking for these things which are permanent is like looking for a tortoise with a moustache. That's what he said. That was his simile. There is no tortoise with a moustache. Tortoises don't have moustaches. And life is a bit like that. We look for things which we cannot have. But by taking in a little bit of Dhamma, remembering impermanence, we let go a little bit. We don't hold on quite so hard anymore. And it can be useful on many, many levels, just with your belongings in life. How attached are you to your belongings in life? One day, a burglar has entered your house and stolen your favorite thing, whatever it is. And you think, oh no, that's terrible. And the way to test yourself, imagine your house burning down. Now, what is the one thing that you would have wanted to save from that house if it was burning down? And that is the thing you're most attached to. So remind yourself, this one day, you're going to have to let go of that. And when you remember that, I'm going to have to let go of it. Just that memory, just that reflection is enough to let go a little bit. So this is part of the Buddhist path, is to remember impermanence. If you remember that, if you reflect on that, it means you're starting to let go gradually, gradually, gradually. And it goes together with the practice. When you practice like metta and kindness and goodness and precepts and all these things, you're creating a sense of happiness, a sense of independence inside of yourself. Because you're doing good things, you feel good about yourself. Because you're practicing metta, you feel good about yourself. That goodness inside of yourself makes you more independent of the world outside. Because you have a sense of well-being inside of yourself. It doesn't depend on external objects for your happiness anymore. Because it doesn't depend on external objects for happiness, it improves your ability to let go of the world outside. So your general practice of kindness and goodness goes together with the understanding of impermanence. Both together means that you can let go more easily. This is how letting go happens. Letting go being a very important part of the Buddhist teachings. So these are all tools, in a sense, tools we use to advance us on the Buddhist path and the Buddhist practice. Is it wrong to reject all Christian dogma instilled in you as a child and embrace another religion? It depends what you mean, I suppose, by Christian dogma. I mean, there are nice things in Christianity. Yeah? There are, you know, I mean, sometimes you have things like the golden rule, you should treat another person like you would like to be treated yourself, this kind of thing. These are beautiful things. I don't know if they count as dogma or what, but there are good things in all religions, in all philosophies, in all things. Don't reject the good things. It's interesting, actually, the golden rule is apparently a rule that you find in all religions. You read, when you know the discourses of the Buddha, it's in there as well. The Buddha said this. Jesus Christ is supposed to have said it. I think it exists in the Quran. I think apparently it exists everywhere, pretty much. It's like a universal thing that all religions have in common. And also, I think, like moral philosophy also has that sort of thing in common. So even atheists usually believe in the golden rule. So what I suggest you do, and rather than just rejecting things outright, first of all, accept that there are things in common between the Buddhist teaching and the Christian teaching, and the good things they have in common, certainly keep those, don't throw them out. When it comes to other dogma, for example, the idea of a creator God, we don't have a creator God in Buddhism, they have it in Christianity. Don't throw it out prematurely. Don't throw it out as an act of will. The day may come when suddenly you feel, of course there is no creator God. Why am I even believing in this? This is what happened to me. I remember one day, I had sort of rejected the idea of a God a long time ago. I've always sort of been a kind of agnostic or atheist most of my life, except when I was a child, and before I became a Buddhist. But one day it became really strong, and I realized the whole idea of a God doesn't make any sense to me at all. And it was like I felt a kind of like a sense of a complete rejection of that idea. To me, it just was completely out of the window, in a sense. And it came naturally. It just came as a consequence of being practicing Buddhism or moving in that direction. It's like a rejection just happened of that idea. And that, I think, is the good idea way of doing it. Don't force these things onto yourself. Don't say, I must be a Buddhist in this way, so I must reject these things. Just keep an open mind. Keep practicing. And one day you decide for yourself what is right and what is wrong. Perhaps you decide there is a God and you become a Christian. You know, that's a possibility as well. But there are lots of Christians in this world. And obviously that is because they have decided that there is a God. Sometimes Buddhists do become Christians. And it's okay. Maybe saying it's okay is a bit dangerous as a Buddhist, because, but my point is that we cannot force these things. If you reflect naturally and you practice in a certain way and you feel there is a God, you can't really force away that feeling. You can't sort of say, oh no, there isn't a God. You can't use your rational mind. But only so far. And if the feeling is very strong, sometimes you just have to go with the feeling. Otherwise, you're just going to hurt yourself too much. So I think that is the best advice. Don't force these kind of things. If you do, you're going to end up suffering more. Okay. Is there a physical place in the brain where the mind resides? And if so, will scientists ever locate it? Okay. I'm not sure if I can predict whether science will ever locate it or not. Don't know about that. But I think the usually the Buddhist idea is that the mind and the body are roughly in the same kind of areas. The mind fills up the body and the body fills the space of the mind. So roughly it's the same kind of space. So the mind and the body, they say in the Buddhist text that it's possible to draw the mind out of the body. And then when you draw the mind out of the body, you're basically creating like a replica of yourself. So you get like, you know, two people, two Ajahn Brahmalis sitting here. And apparently it's possible to create many, many replicas of yourself. They say in the suttas that you can create like 1,000 replicas of yourself. That would be a bit scary, wouldn't it? So these are the things that you can do. But I don't think it's right to say that the mind has a particular place in the body. It's more like they are what you might say coterminous. They have a similar kind of area in which they are. And I think one of the important points in Buddhism is that the mind is not dependent entirely on the body for its existence. Because in Buddhism we have the idea of rebirth, we have the idea that the mind can move on to a new life in the future. Now, if the consciousness was completely dependent on the body for its existence, for the brain for its existence, then when the body dies, the mind will also die, right? And that is like the kind of general accepted view of modern science, is that there isn't really any proof of this, just the scientific view, is that the mind is generated by the brain. And we experience the world because the brain generates consciousness and feelings and all these kind of things. But the reality, when you look at the science, it is a very poorly understood area, the idea of brain and mind and consciousness and all these kind of things. And the Buddhist view is quite different. It is that consciousness can exist apart from the physical body. And that's why when the physical body dies, the mind has a chance to move on into a new existence in accordance with the karma of the past lives. So that is an very important distinction between Buddhism and kind of the generally accepted view in the scientific community. I don't think, sometimes people try to portray it as a scientific truth that the consciousness is derived from the brain, but I think that is very, very far from right. In fact, science doesn't know very much about how consciousness is generated at all. It's a very uncertain area. And there is some very interesting research that has been done on things like rebirth by some very fairly well-known scientists. And some research which is very powerful, and I think that there is, at least from my perspective, quite good scientific evidence to show that there is such a thing as rebirth. But anyway, I won't get into that any further. Okay, so why, when many spiritual traditions allow the use of sacraments to gain knowledge, does Buddhism require abstinence from them in the five precepts? What does it mean that, in what sense does one use sacraments in other religious traditions? What is the idea? Yeah. Okay. In what sense are they used? What are you thinking of? Are you meaning like drugs, that sort of thing? Is that what you mean? Or yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Like the shamanistic kind of shamanistic religion, that sort of things. Okay. Yeah. Well, the reason is I think the reason is because of the difference of the goal of the different religious traditions. And in the shamanistic religion, the idea is very often to alter some kind of altered state of consciousness, you know, whereby you, I think exactly how you enter that altered state of consciousness is not so important as the fact that it is an altered state of consciousness. In Buddhism, it's not just about entering some kind of altered state of consciousness, it's about mindfulness, about being clear, and about knowing what's happening, what's going on. And that mindfulness is very often interrupted by, you know, drugs and alcohol. And that is one of the problems. That's what we're trying to get away from in Buddhism. Sometimes people say, oh, but there are certain drugs which lead to, you know, kind of clarity, you know, and that sort of thing. I mean, I haven't ever used much drugs myself. I don't really know much about these things. But still, it's not reality anymore. It's like a change of reality. The idea in Buddhism is to be as close to reality as possible, so you know what's actually happening and you can understand the world as it actually is. If you change things in an artificial way, you're no longer dealing with the world as it appears directly. You're dealing with some kind of altered perception through chemical substances. So I think those are the two reasons. But the most important one is simply that you have to be mindful. And that is why, in particular, alcohol is so bad, because it really decreases your mindfulness and your ability to even understand the distinction between right and wrong. Right and wrong goes out the window. And if you look at the so much drug-induced crime everywhere around the world these days, it happens because your ability to distinguish between right and wrong again disappears with so many of these drugs. So morality is such an important foundation, and mindfulness is again also a very important foundation on the Buddhist path, and that is why these things are basically not out, basically. Make sense? Yeah? Okay, if someone has hurt you or in your mind wronged you, how do you let go of negative emotions, i.e. feeling, anger, hurt, resentment? How do you let go of the past? Okay, this is obviously a very important question. This is the kind of question that we all need to resolve from time to time. What when somebody has done something wrong to you? And there are many things you can do. But this is, if you're going to have success in your metta meditation, it's very important to deal with these kind of blockages when you have some sort of resentment or upset from somebody else, to be able to deal with that. Because without dealing with that, it's going to block your ability to practice metta properly. So this is actually very important. Now, one of the many, many things you can do, but one of the things that I have found very useful in my own life is to always remember that when somebody does something towards you, or there is some kind of problem between you and somebody else, it seems like a personal problem, remember that these things are never personal. It's never between you and that person. It's not a personal issue. That is the most important thing to remember. Because I think maybe the most important reason why we get so upset is because we feel these issues are personal. This person has hurt me. It's about this person and myself. If you take away the idea that it's personal, you take away 90%, I think, of the problem that is involved. How can I say that is not personal? What do I mean by that? What I mean is that when somebody does something wrong to you, it is not because of you that they do this wrong thing here. The reason they do it is because there is a certain conditions coming into place. You happen to be right there and then. You happen to have certain qualities that trigger that other person. And then because of that trigger and because of those qualities and that person being in a particular frame of mind, that is when these bad things happen. Now, if it had been between two other people and exactly the same conditions, exactly the same situation was there, it would have happened in exactly the same way between two other people. It is just like when, you know, defilements arise because of cause and conditions. Stupidity arises because of cause and conditions, not because of persons, not because of you, not because of the other person, but because of cause and conditions. It's never, ever personal. It's never me against them, or them against me, or anything like that. It's impersonal every time. And when you remember that this person is not reacting towards you, all they are reacting to is cause and conditions, well then it is so much easier to let go and to accept, okay, it's nothing to do with me, nothing to do with them, just allow it to go out the window. It's an easy thing to say, and I have to warn that almost all of these kind of teachings like this is like a teaching of non-self, where you understand that people act in according to cause and conditions, These are things you have to think about again and again and again to allow it to sink in. And as it sinks in, as it becomes part of your understanding in a very profound sense, that is when it becomes a powerful tool. Everything is like that. You have to try it again and again and again. Week after week, month after month, year after year. And as it sinks in, it becomes more and more powerful, more and more sharp, and it starts to work. So that is the first one. That is the first way of overcoming resentment. Remember, it is never, ever, ever personal. It's just cause and conditions. There's nothing between you and that person. Second thing you can do, and this is also quite useful sometimes, is to remember that if somebody really does something hurtful towards you, and particularly if they do it with like bad intent or in a wrong way, then they are going to have to receive the results of that bad karma in the future. If you do something bad, you feel bad about it afterwards. How do you feel when you do something bad? You feel kind of not too happy. You feel it sort of darkens your mindset a little bit. Maybe you have remorse afterwards. Maybe you even feel like, you know, asking for forgiveness because of what you said. Nobody is very happy about that. And the same thing is happening in this person. Even if they don't have an active sense of remorse, there's something inside of them which goes a little bit more dark, a little bit more negative, and then they have to suffer as a consequence. And on top of that comes karma, the laws of karma in the grander scale of things, that you always have to reap the results of the things that you do. And when you think of it like that, you think that, well, actually, this person was just acting out of cause and conditions without really understanding what they were doing. And still, they have to reap suffering in the future as a consequence. Then you can start almost to have compassion on that person instead. Because you start to understand that they are also the victim of their own actions. In fact, they are likely to be a much greater victim of their actions than you are. They are likely to suffer much more than you are if they do something that is truly bad. And the other thing to do is that if somebody does something bad, maybe there's even a habitual badness in a relationship, things happen all the time, it's important to extract yourself a little bit from that relationship. Not allow yourself to be a victim of other people's stupidity. Even if they're just stupid, even if they can't really be blamed, still you have to extract yourself to make sure that you don't get hurt by that situation. It is very hard to overcome anger and negativity and have compassion for somebody if you are around them all the time. You need that distance sometimes. And that is why it is so great to be able to come here, to come on a meditation retreat, to take some time out, to go sit in your own little room and do some meditation by yourself, to get that distance, to get away from that other person. And then you can start to see things more clearly. That is the other thing I recommend. Don't try to always be around them and always do the right thing, because you won't be able to do that if it is a hurtful relationship. Extract yourself. Pull yourself back a little bit. Get a bit more perspective. And then you know what the right amount, if any, is advisable in that particular relationship. Yes? Yeah. But that is possible, that because very often we tend to get reborn together because you have attachment to somebody. And attachment is a very powerful cause for rebirth in the future together. You know, if you have this roughly the same karma and roughly done roughly the same things in this life, so you're going in roughly the same direction, if you have attachment, you will meet again in the future. So that, yes, it is quite possible that that comes from past life. And of course, if it comes from a past life and you have a very long history, even past life history together, it makes it often more difficult because it's very entrenched problems, very entrenched positions. So in that case, often it's even more important that you get a bit of distance, you move a bit apart, you allow yourself a bit of clarity in this kind of relationships. And this is one of the things that I have learned from the monastic life, because at Bodhinyana Monastery, we have very little meetings together. We meet maybe once a week to hear a Dhamma talk by Ajahn Brahm, and we have like the meal together in the middle of the day. But apart from that, we can basically stay in our own hut as much as we want. And it's great because it means that you always have as much space as you want. So if there is any problem, I must admit there's very, very little problem in our monastery, but if there happens to be a problem, you can always extract yourself and always move back. And that is one of the wonderful and great benefits of monastic life. And the same is true also for lay life. You have to do the same kind of thing if you can. Okay. So, next one. How do you differentiate mind from self? Okay. So, mind is a naturally occurring thing. Mind is all the things that is happening inside of you. When you look inside of you, you see feelings, you see perceptions, you perceive things, you have emotions, you have consciousness, you are aware of things. This is mind. Mind is a naturally occurring thing here. It's always there. Mind and body, that's what we are basically here. Now, self is an artificial construct. Self is something which refers to a permanent entity here, right? This is the kind of meaning of self. It's like a soul in Christianity. A soul is something inside of you which gets released when you die, and it's supposed to be a permanent entity which gets released. And the idea of self in Buddhism is a similar kind of idea. It's a feeling you have. You have a feeling that you exist somehow, but not quite sure exactly where it is. And when you look deeply, the deeper you look, the more you see that actually I can't really find this self which is supposed to be there. It feels like I'm here, but where exactly am I here? And that is the thing here. So the difference between self and mind, that mind is something which actually exists. Self is an artificial construct that you cannot find in reality. There's no such thing actually there. That is really the distinction between the two of them. And one of the things in Buddhism, and this is the more you kind of come to terms with the idea of no self, the more you can let go in meditation practice. The more you think that there is somebody in here who is supposed to control, to be in charge, something permanent inside of you. If you think that, well, you're going to control her. The more you realize that things are always changing, always moving around, that nobody is really in charge, then the more you can just sit back on your cushion and just relax and allow things to be here. And when you do that, when you really allow things to be here, you become peaceful. So that is the trick, to just really, really allow things to be here. And this has all to do with this idea of non-self. Does that make sense? I'm happy with that answer? Is that what you had in mind? Yeah? Okay, good. So, move on to the next one. Is a fresh start somewhere else a good idea, or is it all in the mind? I feel uninspired in Perth, but I feel maybe I'm just trying to run away. Okay, gee, I hope you're not too uninspired by me. I'm not the one who makes you run away. I think sometimes a fresh start can be a good thing. I'm not sure. I guess you're referring to your... I'm not sure what... I guess presumably you're referring to your ordinary life here, because otherwise you probably wouldn't be here. So sometimes it can be a good thing, but you really have to sort of... decide what is important in your life. I think this is one of the really kind of crucial things when you make decisions in life. One of the beautiful things that I was always struck by the suttas is, this is the word of the Buddha, what the Buddha said. The Buddha said that when you make a decision in life, when you decide whether you should move here or move there, whether you should, almost whatever you should do, he always said that the most important thing to take into account are the spiritual implications of what you're doing here. So if you want to change your job, for example, well, what is that change of job going to do for you? If you only do it to advance your career, but it may actually be damaging spiritually, then is it really a good idea? For example, if you take on a job which is very stressful and very kind of hard and you don't really feel up to it, then perhaps you are going to come back and you're going to shout at your family members, and you could become a more terrible person because you haven't got enough peace in your life anymore. You haven't got enough relaxation. It's too stressful. But as a practicing person who is on the spiritual path and who is trying to be kind and good, you have to have your priorities very, very clear. And if your priorities are that you want to be kind and compassionate and a good person first, then even such a thing as a job change, you ask yourself, how is it going to affect my spiritual life? And I would say the same thing here. You know, if you are asking for a start, a new start somewhere else, it's not always wrong, but ask yourself why you want that fresh start. How is it going to affect those things which are really important in life? What really matters for you? Where can you become a better person? Where can you deepen your meditation practice? Where can you get more wisdom? These are the things that are really important. And if you think that a fresh start is going to help you to improve in that sense, then by all means, go for it. But think carefully here. Don't just move because of some trifling worldly issue like, I want a bigger house, or, you know, I want to meet some new people. I mean, these sort of things are so uncertain anyway. Maybe you get a bigger house, maybe you like it, maybe you don't. Maybe you get some new friends, maybe they're nice, maybe they're not. They're just so uncertain. Ask yourself the really important questions. Is it going to make me a better person or not? And then I think you are making a decision in the right way. Okay. Okay, so here we are. What is your understanding of rebirth? Rebirth is one of those topics that is often debated a lot, but the understanding that you find in the discourses of the Buddha, in the suttas, is essentially that there is such a thing as rebirth, as going from life to life. When you die, when you pass away, you will move on into a new existence somewhere else. It doesn't all end with when you die. There is such a thing as rebirth. That is very, very clear, as far as I'm concerned, in the word of the Buddha, the way the Buddha spoke. And for that, whether you know that for yourself or whether it's something you take on faith, I always, you know, if you cannot see it, I always thought to myself, well, even if I can't see it, at the very least, I should take it as my working hypothesis that there is such a thing as rebirth. I'm a Buddhist. I'm even a Buddhist monk. I have a lot of faith in the word of the Buddha. If the Buddha said so, it must be very important. So I will take it on as a working hypothesis. And maybe one day I will be able to see it for myself. I think that is a very wise way of looking at rebirth, because you cannot really know with absolute certainty until you get there yourself whether there is rebirth or not. You don't have to say with absolute certainty, I'm a Buddhist, there must be rebirth, because you don't know. Accept that you don't know. But take it on as like a working hypothesis, or maybe at the very least have an open mind about it. When you have that, then I think you're going in the right direction and looking at it in the right way. If you do have a very strong sense that there is rebirth, that's good too. That's perfectly fine. And that's certainly aligned with the Buddha's teachings. Now, why is it that the teaching of rebirth is so important? Now, the first reason, obviously, is that rebirth and karma together give a very strong basis for living an ethical life. If you know that you're going to have to reap the result of the actions in a future life, it's a very good grounds for actually being kind and good-hearted and developing yourself. That is the first thing. It's pretty obvious. But the other thing, and I think this is much more important, at least in my life, the way I look at the Buddhist teachings, that if you really understand rebirth, and this is where the more profound aspects of Buddhism come in, if you really understand rebirth, if you understand that you have been doing this again and again, hundreds, thousands of times before, going around life after life after life, being born, being a small child, being a rebellious adolescent, then having kids yourself and being upset with your adolescent kids, you know how things are. And then going through life and then maybe wondering at the end of the life, what was that all about? I've been living for 70 years, you know, this seems like I've sort of done my thing. It doesn't seem all that meaningful. And then you think that you've done this again and again and again. And every time you come back, you make roughly the same mistakes, fall into the same traps, have roughly the same kind of suffering. After a while, you think, enough of all this. This is just madness. They're absolute crazy. There's only one thing that makes sense. That is to make an end of this whole rebirth issue. And that is really the important aspect of rebirth, is to understand that actually it's quite a terrible thing in the long run. Yes, you may be a good person in this life, and by being a good person in this life, you can ensure that you get a reasonable, decent rebirth in the future. But in the long run, you don't know if you're always going to be a decent person. Because things are non-self, because you get conditioned by your surroundings, because sometimes you get the wrong kind of friends, hang out with the wrong crowd, you end up doing all kind of crazy things. And then you suffer terribly as a consequence. So because of this, and this is like the really deep aspect of Buddhism, to understand why rebirth is so important. Because ultimately, it drives you out of this whole thing we call rebirth and towards Nibbana. Nibbana is precisely that, the ending of rebirth. Nothing more, nothing less. And that is why it is so profound. So that is just some thoughts about rebirth. Was that what the person was asking about? Happy with that? Yeah? Okay. Good. Okay, so other meditation traditions talk about chakras, the cleaning of chakras, as well as an energy within we often call kundalini. What is the Buddhist perspective on chakra and kundalini energy? Yeah, that's a good question. I think, basically, I don't know, but I think the thing is that there are many ways of kind of awakening energy within inside of you. And it's certainly in Buddhism, we also talk about energy as well, but it's not related to kind of physical positions in the body. These chakras, if I understand correctly, are like physical positions in the body. The word chakra actually means wheel. It's a Sanskrit word which means wheel. But of course, in meditation, when meditation starts to work, you certainly feel a lot of energy. Your mind starts to brighten up. You feel a sense of joy. You feel a sense of happiness inside. And you also feel very energetic. So energy is a very, very important part of the Buddhist practice as well. It's a naturally occurring energy that comes as your meditation goes deeper and as it starts to work. And it's very important to have that energy. When you have that energy, things become very joyful, very happy. You know, you jump up and down, you sort of have this kind of lightness about yourself. And it's a joyful kind of experience. So the energy itself is very important. I don't think in Buddhism we don't normally call it anything in particular. We don't necessarily call it the kundalini. We don't place it in any particular location. But the idea of energy is still very important and a very important aspect. And that is very often you will see that some of the most impressive kind of meditation teacher that I have seen over the years and over my lifetime as a monk are the people who are very energetic. You know, they can run around and they can do things continuously all day long. They can have like an itinerary that most people would exhaust them completely and they still can keep it up because the energy comes from inside of them. There's like a joy and a kind of ability, spiritual ability inside, which brings up this fount of energy inside of you. So energy is very important. And the more spiritually advanced you are, the more energy you tend to have. That is another way of actually measuring your ability in meditation, how things are going. How much energy do you feel? If you feel tired or a little bit depressed, you have no energy. Depression lacks energy. Joy and happiness is the opposite end of the spectrum. It gives rise to energy and happiness. How do you maintain loving kindness and compassion within yourself and to someone close to you who is angry and does not treat you well? I talked a bit about this before, how to deal with angry people is to remember the many, many things to remember. Remember that they suffer even more from their anger than you are likely to suffer. Angry people are not happy people. Anger is always a very negative state of mind. It's a painful state of mind. So remember that this is a person who has pain. It's difficult for them. At the same time, it depends, I suppose, on how close the relationship is, but don't allow yourself to be abused by this person, make sure that you get enough distance so you look after yourself. You make sure you protect yourself from people who are difficult. If we don't protect ourselves, we are not going to be able to advance ourselves spiritually, and we're not really going to be able to function properly here. So make sure, it's very important to extricate yourself sometimes from difficult relationships. And as you get a bit more distance, you're able to have more compassion, understanding on that person as well. Huh? So, So I don't know exactly. It's very, sometimes things are often very complicated, because sometimes people are difficult and we are attached to them even though they are difficult, and sometimes the complications are very, very great. So sometimes you just have to say, okay, quite firmly with yourself, okay, I'm going to pull myself back a little bit because this is not working out. And then see what happens when you pull back. Maybe that will sort things out. Sometimes it does. Sometimes people are angry and they treat you badly because they feel that you are attached to them. They can do exactly what they want, and there's no, and you are the kind of person who sort of goes along anyway. So by showing that you have a little bit of independence, they may actually treat you better simply because of that. A person who is not independent is a person who is very easy to bully and to manipulate emotionally. But that is the first aspect of having kindness and compassion within yourself, is to look after yourself first of all, to make sure that you look after yourself. It's very interesting, when the Buddha was once asked, there was a king, Pasenadi of Kosala in India, one of the great kingdoms there. He was a disciple of the Buddha, this king. And he went to the Buddha and he asked the Buddha, is it true, as my queen Mallika says, that we all love ourselves the most? And the Buddha said, yes, of course that's true. We all love ourselves the most because we are closest to ourselves. There's nobody closer to us than ourselves. Because of that, we have the very first obligation we have is towards ourselves, to make sure that we are happy, that we are okay, that we are doing well. And then, once you establish a happiness inside of yourself, that gives you the internal psychological resources to be able to help others as well. If you don't have those things inside of yourself, you can't really help others. So you have to have that inside of yourself first. Then you can help others. And then by helping others, you're helping yourself even more. One of the beautiful definitions that I like about the spiritual life is that a spiritual life is anything which is good for you and good for other people. So anything you do which is beneficial both for yourself and for others, that is like a spiritual act, spiritual speech, spiritual thought. It's a very easy kind of way of remembering those things. Okay, please interrupt me if you want to ask something. That's perfectly fine. I'll go on maybe for another 10 minutes or so, and then we'll call it a night afterwards. When progress is very slow, what ways can motivation be kept up? Okay. Very important part of the practice of meditation and any spiritual practice is to always investigate. So if progress is slow, perhaps you feel that you are standing still even, ask yourself why. What do I need to change? What isn't really working? For example, if you're trying to watch the breath, perhaps you have started trying to watch the breath too early. Perhaps what you need to do is to purify yourself a little bit more. Maybe that's why it isn't working. So try some loving-kindness meditation instead. So always investigate. Ask yourself, why isn't it working? What is stopping me? What is blocking me? What is the problem right here and now? And through that investigation, you can start to put the practice into the right area where you really need to do things. And loving kindness is almost always a good thing to do. It's almost always, it has a very powerful purifying aspect to it. So always try to do some loving kindness meditation. Even if you think you don't need it, do it still, because you probably do. I think almost everybody does. So try that. And be very persistent, be persevering, because things like loving kindness meditation, it takes time to get hold of it, to get the hang of it. How do you do it? How do you make these emotions and feelings arise in yourself? It's not easy. It takes a certain kind of mental state. You have to understand your mind, how your mind clicks, how it works, how you get around to these things. And as you get around to them, as you start to see how it works, you start to function better for you. And then you start to have some results in that meditation practice. So be very persistent. When you come on a meditation retreat like this, only for a weekend, it's a very short time. The most important thing is just to learn to chill out, to take it easy, to have a good time, to be at ease. That is the most important thing here. So just find a sense of ease. If you start to think, oh, I'm not having enough progress, that means you're becoming impatient. When you are impatient, craving arises. When you have craving, the willpower starts to rear its ugly head. And then when the willpower comes into the equation, you start to push yourself too much, you lose the sense of ease. You lose the sense of being relaxed. Willpower takes over, and it becomes even worse. So be careful with that. Be very careful with that impatience. If you are patient, you are relaxed. If you are impatient, you tend not to be relaxed. So patience is so important. So even if you just come here and enjoy yourself, just by being at ease and being relaxed, you're doing plenty good enough. You're doing well already. If you get some nice meditation on top of that, great. And you're doing really, really well. Most people in the world can't even relax. So if you're able to relax, you are already one of those few people on the right track. Okay. How do I make a non-believer in meditation and retreats understand? Basically, you don't. That's basically the answer. Unfortunately. The problem is that if we try to teach other people, one of the things I've always noticed, if we try to teach people, they tend to become resistant. They don't want to hear, they don't want to listen, because they feel that they are being like put upon by somebody else. They want to change me, but I want to do things in my own way. So it's very important not to try to push people too much, because they're not going to listen. They're going to resist. They're going to become defensive. I want my life in my way. And they're not going to listen to what you say. So much better than doing that is just to be a good example. Show that the practice works. Practice in your own life. Just be independent. Do the own thing. Do what works in your life. Show that it's working for you. You're happy. You are at ease. You are well adjusted. And after a while, the other person will start to ask, what's going on here? What's happening here? And that becomes very beautiful, because then they are coming from themselves. They are seeking. And when they are seeking, that means they are ready to actually to understand. Sometimes you can, you know, if this is somebody you know well, you can maybe leave things around, which sort of, you know, they can pick up. I know that Ajahn Brahm often says that if you have like a child or something you would like to read, but they are maybe very rebellious or whatever, sometimes you just have to leave things around the house. And then when they see them, they will pick it up on their own and they will start reading these things. It's very difficult to get a teenager to do what you want, so you have to sort of make them think that they're doing it on their own accord. When they think they're doing it on their accord, they will certainly do it. So that is a kind of trick you can use to get people interested, perhaps. Never to make them feel that they are being kind of pushed into something, but have the sense that they are coming from their own wisdom. When people feel that they're coming from their own wisdom, their own understanding, then they will take an interest in these things. I remember with myself, for me it was also very interesting, because when I first became a monk about 17 years ago, my parents were kind of wailing and upset and up in arms. What, becoming a Buddhist monk? You must be out of your mind. You know, what did we do wrong in the upbringing and all this kind of stuff? And it was a bit uncomfortable for me, to say the least, but I had decided that this was the right thing. This is what I wanted to do. So I went ahead anyway. And of course, over the years, there has been enormous change in how my parents look at these things. First of all, they have seen that, you know, it's not Buddhism is not a bad thing, it's not a sect, it's not some kind of place where you get absolutely brainwashed and asked to do crazy things, you know, it doesn't work like that. It's actually a very decent and very good philosophy, you know, it may not even be a religion for that matter. And then they see that their, you know, their son is thriving in this thing here. And then gradually they come around. And until now, in these days, they read Buddhist books. They, when I go with them somewhere, maybe on a holiday or whatever, they tell me, oh, you know, give us a little bit of a talk about Buddhism, that sort of thing. Yeah. And this is amazing how this has changed. In the early days, I was sort of thinking, oh, I have to teach my parents about Buddhism. But I quickly realized this is not going to work. So I put all that aside. I just was myself. I just tried to be kind and helpful, to be considerate and decent towards my parents. And that is what really worked. And over time, they have come around almost completely to the point where now they virtually consider themselves Buddhist as well. That is a big, big change. And that is not going to happen with everybody, because not everybody is ready to become a Buddhist. Some people may have the wrong kind of attitudes, the wrong kind of baggage. But if it's going to happen, it's going to happen in that way, and not by trying to push the beliefs onto people. So I think that is really the answer. You can't really control other people. It's difficult enough to control ourselves and our own life and to make sure we do it right. Controlling others is just, there's just no way. You just have to allow it to come naturally. Do ghosts really exist? Yeah, good question. The best thing to do is to keep meditating and find out for yourself. That is the. It takes a while, but according to the Buddha's teachings, they do exist. So there is such a thing as a ghost realm, and it's a place of suffering, maybe not tremendous, a lot of suffering, more suffering than the human realm. They're often depicted on, like, you know, when they are painted or whatever. Sometimes you go to monasteries in Asia and you can see these paintings of all kind of realms and things, and you see ghosts often depicted as these beings with enormous bellies and tiny mouths, very hungry, but they can hardly eat. And this is a kind of thing, you know, insatiable appetite. So, yes, they, according to Buddhism, they do exist. And sometimes ghosts can be around the human realm. There was one famous monk in Thailand. He said he went to the United States, and he went to many people's houses in the United States, you know, like monks sometimes do when they travel around. And then when he came back from the U.S., he said that, well, one thing he said was very obvious in the U.S., was all the ghosts in these houses, because he's supposed to be able to see these ghosts. And he said that the reason he reckoned why there were so many ghosts in American houses is because people are very attached to their material belongings, and the houses in particular. So when they die, they're not able to break the attachment, and they get reborn as a ghost in their own house. And this apparently is, at least in the U.S., is quite common. And it's probably quite common in the rest of the world as well, because people are often attached to their houses. So be careful not to be reborn in a ghost in your own house. It's not the same when you're a ghost as when you're an ordinary person. You can't enjoy the house in the same way, so it's not recommended. So try to avoid that. But one of the things that the Buddha also said is that it is actually possible to do acts of kindness towards these ghosts. So if somebody in your family has been reborn as a ghost, and there will be somebody, because we have been reborn so many times, there's always going to be somebody back there somewhere that was a ghost. You can actually say, you can do something kind, do a good act, keep the five precepts, do something good, and then say, I dedicate this kindness to you, wherever you are. And again, mean it with your heart. And then they will be able to feel that, according to the Buddha. They will be able to feel and see what you're doing. And they will sometimes, that will be enough for their mind to be elated. And then they can actually take rebirth somewhere else, rather than in the realm of ghosts. And that is a beautiful way of being able to help somebody who has departed. So that this is why in Buddhism we do all this kind of ceremony sometimes for departed people. And people, traditionally in Asia, they will go to the monastery and they will offer food for the monks. They might keep the five precepts, and they will dedicate the merit of what they've done to the departed. But it doesn't have to be an offering to the monks. It can be any kind of goodness that you do can be dedicated to the departed. So it's a nice thing to do. It's another kind of act of loving kindness for people who are not even here anymore. It's a very selfless kind of way of acting, because you have no idea who these people actually are sometimes. Yes? Yeah. Right.
So they come
and Yeah. Well, I mean, from a Buddhist point of view, there are many different types of beings around, you know, and one of them are ghost beings, but there are also other beings it could be as well. There are other things as well. So yeah, I guess you just don't know. But even a ghost will have a tendency to come and go and approach and then, you know, disappear again. They won't be there all the time. The presence will be like intermittent. But usually, most of the time, it is a ghost. So I would say that if that is actually happening to you, it means that there is a person, there is this being in suffering around you. So when you feel their presence, wish them well. Don't be afraid. Don't sort of, you know, think, oh, go away or whatever. Wish them well instead. And by wishing them well, you're actually doing them a favor. And then they might be able to, you know, to move to a higher plane or a better state of existence or whatever. This is one of the beautiful things in Buddhism. We never use any kind of violence, even towards the ghosts, you know. So even to ghosts, we have a sense of compassion and kindness. Yeah. And that is what sometimes as monks, one of the things we do as monks is we get invited to people's houses to do ghost busting. People say, oh, we've got a ghost in our house, please do something. It's creating all kinds of problems for us. And the ghost busting is very simple. The ghost busting is we do a bit of chanting. We wish the ghost well. May you be happy. May you get reborn in a good realm. That is really all it is, you know. And then, you know, if it works, the ghost moves on because they feel, oh, we have been treated nicely and kindly, so now it's time to move on. Sometimes it doesn't work, but sometimes it works. So, yeah. Okay, one last question for the evening here. Do you believe that the number of enlightened beings or general human progress towards enlightenment is increasing, or is the bodhisattva's path doomed? Okay. Yeah, I must admit, I'm a very traditional Buddhist, and I'm not a great fan of the bodhisattva path, to be honest with you. And you're quite right. With so many bodhisattvas around, there should be an enormous amount of enlightened beings, shouldn't there? But in fact, what I observe is that there are very few enlightened beings around. In fact, so few that you'd be very lucky to ever meet a single enlightened being in your entire life. That's how few there are. Extremely few, extremely rare, and very far between. I don't think people quite understand how rare it is to find somebody, not only somebody who is enlightened, but somebody who is even on the path to enlightenment. In Buddhism, we're talking about four stages of enlightenment, starting with stream entry, and even a stream entry, somebody who has seen the Dhamma fully, penetrated it fully, is extremely, extremely rare person to find in this world. Let alone somebody who is fully enlightened, an arahant. Very, very rare. So, in our day and age, there is you should be very, very lucky to even meet a single stream enterer in your entire life. That is how rare they are. Even if you're the kind of person who likes to hang out, to get, you know, around good monks and nuns, and I think it's fair to say that it's in the monastic sangha, you're more likely to find enlightened beings simply because the practice there is like, you know, more 100% devoted towards that. So it's more likely. It's not impossible in lay life, but it's generally more difficult. And that's why the Buddha established the monastic sangha in the first place, because it is like supposed to be the ideal vehicle for enlightenment. But even if you meet large numbers of monks and nuns in your life, the chances still of meeting even one stream enterer is very, very small. So if you find that you have found a good teacher, somebody who is special, somebody who really is, really good meditator, has all the right qualities, the wisdom and all that, hold on, don't let go. It is an incredibly rare gift to find somebody very special in the world. It's very rare and very difficult to find. And I know that in the Buddha's discourses, the Buddha said, well, if you have a person that you're with, or you are staying in a place where you are improving in good qualities and declining in bad qualities, then even if you're asked to leave, you should cling on to that person and not leave, because you are going in the right direction. The whole purpose of life is to improve in good qualities and decline in bad qualities. So if that is happening, you are in the right place with the right person. Again, very pragmatic teaching, but very, very useful for that reason. Okay. So I think that is enough for tonight. So I'll just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then I will head off. Thank you very much.